Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Jim, did you get that huge box I had delivered to your house?
I don't think so. I mean, no huge boxes have arrived recently.
Well, you should have. It was my 1,000th episode anniversary present for you.
Oh, you didn't have to do that, Patrick.
Yeah, I know. I'm actually kidding. I didn't get you anything.
Oh, that wasn't very nice.
Yeah, that was a cheap trick.
Took a long time, but we got there.
It did take a long time.
Okay, Patrick, you know what today is?
I do, Jim. It's our 1,000th episode. Let me be the first to wish you happy 1,000.
Woohoo! 1,000, man.
We made it, man.
They never, they never thought we'd make it to episode, 12 or whatever, right?
No.
Here we are.
That's right. It looked pretty shaky at the beginning.
That's right. And here we are, number 1,000.
Wow.
Episode of Rockin' the Suburbs. If you don't know who we are by now, I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And, we've been doing this for quite a while. Between this and the old show, it's even a higher number. But just for this show proper, 1,000 episodes. So there you go.
Right. It's the longest anyone's ever continuously talked to me without stopping.
All right. Okay. So we thought for the 1,000th episode that we should do something special, right?
Yep.
And we should have, a big star on the show, don't you think?
That's right.
A big star?
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest we could get.
The biggest one. Right. So we got on the email and we asked this guy if he would come on, and he said he would. And and our big star guest for episode 1,000 is,
drum roll, Rick Nielsen.
Rick,
from Cheap Trick.
Rick Nielsen. Yep.
Rick freaking Nielsen. Yep. Man, dude, it's Cheap Trick.
I know.
That is huge.
This is very
exciting. The guitar player from Cheap Trick.
Yep.
It's massive.
I mean, this is a legendary band, of course, and one of, sort of the great power pop rock guitarists of all time.
Absolutely.
And I've seen this band probably as many times as I've seen any band, I think. You know, it's, and starting from when I was in high school and then up through the time that I lived in Rockford for a while in the 90s, and then beyond there, I saw them play in Louisville. I saw them play here in the DC area. Wherever I go, there's Cheap Trick, because they're always on the road. They're always touring, and they always put on a great live show, and it's been one of my favorite bands for a long, long time. And as you'll hear in this interview, when I mentioned Rockford, I used to live in Rockford, which is the home of Cheap Trick. I had met Rick Nielsen when I lived there. And met his parents and so on. And so we're going to talk about that.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
You're going to hear all that
absolutely
in the interview.
Absolutely. It's great. Yep. Blew my mind.
And he's a very witty guy. You'll also notice in the interview that there's a couple times when he made funny jokes that didn't register with me immediately. But
and he openly insulted me several times.
Yeah. I tell you, that's the kind of guy he is. He's great. All right. So, should we just dive right in here to the interview?
Let's do it.
Here you go, peoples. Episode 1,000, featuring Rick Nielsen. Rick Nielsen, thank you very much for joining us here for our 1,000th episode of Rockin' the Suburbs.
Holy cow.
It's like we've been doing it every day.
Yeah, thanks for thinking of me right away.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Rick and I go way back, although I doubt that he remembers any of this, but
it's about 30 years ago, I remember.
Yeah, 30 years ago, I was a young journalist. My first job out of college, I worked at the Rockford Register Star, and once on a break from a tour, he was nice enough to have me over to his house, and we did an interview, and I wrote a little story, and I also in that story interviewed your parents, who owned the Music Box music store. there, and they were really very, very nice people. And let me show you real quick here, because you can see on the video. This is a guitar.
Oh, really?
Fender guitar here, electric acoustic, that I purchased personally from Ralph Nielsen.
Wow. Holy cow.
That's cool.
Oh, that's very good. He was a good salesman, but he was a little too fair, I think.
That may have been the case. So I wanted to start with this, you know, going back to my experiences in Rockford and getting to know your parents a little bit. How important were your parents, for the listeners who don't know this, they were accomplished musicians themselves. How important were they to you are today?
Well, they had sex once, and here I am.
It's a pivotal moment.
Yeah. So, well, you know, they were. I wasn't in endeared or in love with the music they were doing, but there was always music. You know, my father was a, like you said, very accomplished. I mean, he directed choirs. He directed the Messiah. He directed. He could sing in about 10 different languages. Hmm. And besides that, he played. They were instrumental in a way because by the time I was about 13 or 14, I'd been in almost 48 states, Mexico and Canada, because I traveled with them. Mm-hmm. And so I got the bug there. But it was not my kind of music. I mean, he was a trained musician. I'm a trained SEAL or something like that. But I liked what I liked, and he liked what he liked, and I think it was probably great that I didn't try to do what he was doing, because I'm sure it would have failed. And he tried to didn't do what I do, because I shouldn't say he failed, but he's not here, so I can say whatever I want.
And you guys traveled around in a private plane, right?
Yeah, my dad had a private pilot's license, and he had a group called the Serenaders. And it had two tenors. My dad was a tenor, and a baritone and a bass vocalist, and then he had a keyboard player. Who, if you were down at my dad's store, Jim Angel. I don't know if you remember that guy, Jim Angel. He was his keyboard player. Hmm. I hate to say penis, but
it's a family show.
Yeah. So we traveled around with those guys, and it's like, I just learned a lot. You know, I didn't want to sit home with my mom, and if he had the extra seat in the plane, I went with. And I was, you know, I was a little bit smaller then, so they didn't need a whole seat for me.
There you go. I mean, you say that you weren't really into your dad's music, but...
Yeah, my dad sang for Billy Graham, too. And he had two, he had two radio shows too, WMBI in Chicago, Moody Bible Institute. And so it wasn't the fuddy-duddy kind of religious stuff, but it was, you know, Messiah and stuff like that. That's pretty heavy duty.
Yeah.
You know, things. But, you know, traveling around with my dad, I mean, it was, I don't even know how old I was, but I was in Chicago, and it was the first time I saw, you know, multiracial couples, you know, a black guy with a white woman or a white woman with a, whatever. And it's like, I'd go to these Baptist churches, it's like, holy cow, these guys are having fun in there. And then you go back to the regular, churches like that I went to in Rockford, and it was like, So I just had fun. I had fun going to those things. And, you know, I was always the wise guy, little kid, who I knew music so well, not knowing how to play it, but I knew it from listening to it. And I used to torment my dad's keyboard player, because he was a real fussy individual. And I used to, hey, Jim, and then, you know, on the fourth thing you guys did, you hit a wrong note over in the third, you know, he'd get so flustered, you know, because, you know, one, I'm just a wise guy kid, but I was always right. and that kind of got to him. But I didn't care. I appreciated what my parents did and what all these other musicians did, because I met a lot of them at my dad's store. You know, they had, you know, all the black guys. I was the first guy that played in a club in Rockford called the El Dorado Club. And I was the only white guy that was in there because I could play keyboard and guitar. Hey, Ricky, you know, so I was like a member of the El Dorado Club when I was like about 13 years old.
Wow.
And that was cool. And it's like, but you know, all the people, all the customers my dad had, you know, Asian guys, Hispanic guys, black guys, gay, straight, who knows what they were, you know, I had to deal with everybody. And it's like, you know, I always tell people that I treat people better than they deserve.
Well, as evidence here, I think.
Right? Yes. I was going to mention that towards the end of the show.
So let me ask you this, though. But what I was getting at, though, when you said it wasn't necessarily your kind of music, but it must have had some influence on when you had, you know, more sort of orchestral touches in songs like, say, Dream Police or something like that, that must have come somewhere from that background, right?
Well, yeah. It was, you know, my dad never recorded Dream Police. But, you know, it's like, but I mean, it's like, yeah, I liked the elements of all that. I mean, I just did. I loved orchestra, but I didn't like I can't explain what I did like and what I didn't like. I liked pieces of everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I like people that are sincere and hardworking. And if they hit wrong notes, it's like I know when to tell them and when to... that was interesting.
Yeah.
How can you insult them without insulting them?
Right. How's life been for you during this pandemic? Because you are like constantly touring with Cheap Trick. So what is this? This must be a real shock to your system.
Well, yeah. I mean... I've learned which kids are mine around here. So I never knew who they were. I just thought they were the neighbors or something. But then, you know, I've got grandkids too, so I get to see everybody. But it's too bad that it's, you know, it's like I've never really taken a great vacation. I'm not a vacationing type. You know, it's like I like to be working.
Yeah.
I love to work. I love to goof off too, but I mean, I like to work because it's what I've enjoyed my whole life.
Hey, Rick, I was wondering, you were talking about Chicago, you know, when you were younger, and did you spend a lot of time like in that Chicago blues scene when you were younger, like the stuff like Michael Bloomfield was doing, or of those guys? Yeah.
Yeah. As you know, I used to go to all the clubs early on, blues clubs, and then as I got into when I was in, well, I went to the first show that the Yardbirds played in the United States in 1964, I think it was. It was in Rockford, or was in it? Byron, Illinois, at the Rock River Roller Rink.
Wow.
It was the Yardbirds and then also Mickey They and Them. Hmm. And they had played earlier in the day in Chicago at Eric Cron Theater.
Hmm.
And then they came to Rockford, or, you know, to Byron. It was a roller rink.
That's wild.
Yeah, and I went there and saw them then. And, you know, Jeff Beck's been my favorite guitar player since then.
Has he really? Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I went to his house last December. He invited me. He hadn't invited me back yet, but we went to his house, and he and his wife and my wife and my best friend who lives in England, who's actually from Rockford, but he moved to London. He's been there ever since.
Hmm. Yeah, because I just recently, over the past year or so, have started to learn about Bloomfield, because the guy wrote a book that I got, and it was really interesting to me just what a melting pot Chicago was at that time. You know, it was very interesting. I never knew that.
Well, yeah. I kind of knew a bunch of... not a lot about it, but I knew a bit, because back in late 68, I bought a Mellotron in London, and I went to Chess Studios in Chicago, and I never knew what tracks I was doing. I mean, I recorded there also, but, you know, I'm still not skilled. I'm probably, like a guy that does the keyboard, that does pick. And pecks at it. That's me. But I could do, you know, if you I had the feel for it, but I just didn't have the technique, and I still don't, you know. But I got, you know, I got asked to do stuff because I hung around.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah. And so, you know, back then, Bloomfield, and well, I liked a lot of different guys that I see. Harvey Mandel, I don't know if you know him. Actually, he played in Rockford at a place that my cousin ran, Charlotte's Web, it's called. Mm-hmm. Huh. And there was a lot of people that came through there that I saw. And I used to go to places, too. When I was still in high school, I flew to Cleveland to go see Jeff Beck.
Wow.
It was Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood and Mick Waller and I think it was Chris Stanton or Nicky Hopkins. And
oh,
there was eight people there.
Wow.
That was his first tour. And then I saw him a few months later and at the Kinetic Playground in Chicago, because I used to go there all the time. And I happened to be in the audience, and I was standing up there, and after the first set that the Jeff Beck group did, his roadie picked up his guitar off the amp and dropped it and broke the head off it.
Oh, no.
And back then it was easier to get backstage and stuff, so I went, I said, you don't know me, but Jeff Beck's my favorite guitar player, and I collect guitars. And the guy says, oh, well, here, you know, I didn't have a card, but I wrote down my number. And about 2 weeks later, I got a phone. Hey, Rick, hold on for Jeff Beck. What?
And, wow.
Yeah, Jeff Beck. Hey, Rick, still got guitars? I said, yes. Hold on. We'll talk to my manager. So then they said, Jeff still needs a guitar. What do you have? So I said, come meet us at the show. So he said, well, yeah, but the show's in Philadelphia.
Oh, wow.
So I flew to Philadelphia. I took a friend, buddy of mine. We took, I think it was five guitars. You know, we flew to Philadelphia and went there and saw them. And their plan was the Vanilla Fudge and 10 Years After, I think,
was
all on the show. And he bought my guitar.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah. So the second Les Paul Jeff Beck ever had was mine.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah. So that was by being around. I was like,
yep.
Like being out with my dad. It was like, not that I was doing anything, but I was in the way, in a good way, because I just wanted to learn. And there was no learning in school for me.
Right. You were just sponging everything up that you were around. That's cool.
In seventh grade, I was thrown out of band. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
I was
a school band?
Yeah, school band. It was seventh grade. I was first chair on flute and drums. And I don't know if it was the first semester or the second semester at Lincoln Junior High School. I went up to the band director because I'd been around all these musicians. And, you know, here we are, guys playing a tuba and an oboe, and nobody can play.
Right.
You know, they don't have any rhythm or whatever. I finally went to the band director. I said, Mr. Bischel, you're an incompetent, drunken fool who doesn't deserve to teach music to me or anyone else. Boom! I was thrown out. I was banned from the music program of Rockford Public Schools from seventh grade on.
Wow.
I was never allowed. I was never allowed to be in any of that stuff.
Wow, that's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, my parents thought it was a scream.
That was the highest compliment, yeah, to be thrown out of an organized band. He might make something of himself. he got thrown out of band.
He's going, yeah, really. I mean, who else got thrown out of band? Nobody.
Right. That's hard to do.
Yeah, really.
It's kind of like when Michael Jordan got cut from his high school basketball team, right? And that just inspired him to do more.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, it inspired me that I didn't want to be in a jazz band.
Right.
So there you go. Okay, I wander around here when I talk, so I can't.
Oh, that's fine.
I don't know where we were. Oh, I know what it was.
Yeah,
it was, you talked about the orchestration in Dream Police. Da 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 da. You know, well, that part, it's like, that was one thing that I came up with the idea for it, but you know, every note's been picked way before I picked them.
Yeah,
but also some of the stuff. We used to do this one song called "Loser." Not the one that Beck did, but it was called "Loser." In the middle, I had brought in a section of by Dvorak. It was called "Stabat Mater," and I used that in there. We used to play a tape to go along with this thing. It's like, so I had my classical influences, but where was I going to use them with the, you know, four stacks of Sound City amplifier.
Right.
So I put it. I just used it when I felt like it.
Huh. Very interesting.
Where a lot of fans of the band, a lot of our listeners, they probably wonder this. Like, once you achieved a certain amount of success with Cheap Trick, why did you decide to stick around in Rockford? What's kept you there all these years?
Well, let's see. I'm an only child, so I told you my parents had sex once. You know?
Yeah. Once, yeah.
And you know, so I got married, and I could have lived anywhere, because I've actually, a lot of cities like L.A. or New York, I've lived in those cities more than I have been in my own city, you know, each year, except for this year.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a choice. I mean, I said, my wife, you know, we had babysitters here, for one. And I'd been to so many places. It was like, there's good people where I live, and there's bad people where I live. And every other city in the world, there's good people, there's bad people. And so, you know, I was comfortable here. Plus, being in the Midwest, it was easier to get flights to go anywhere.
Mm.
If I lived on the East Coast, you know, it's like, takes all day to get wet to the West Coast. If you're on the West Coast, it takes 2 days to get to the East Coast.
Right.
But by being in the Midwest, you know, it's a handy place to fly out of. O'Hare's always open, except during the pandemic, you know?
Right.
Right.
So there's one of the reasons why I stayed here. Hmm. Plus, you know, it's like, I realized the prices of real estate, too. I bought my first house in the 60s, and I didn't sell it until 1979 when I bought a big house in Rockford that I had redone. It was built in 1854. I always liked architecture.
Hmm.
It was built in 1854, had 28 rooms, and it was a Clarence Darrow shot pool there. It was
wow.
A big Italian, Victorian place. And it was a wreck when I bought it. And it ended up to be the money pit for me. But it was like, I liked that stuff, and I liked working on it. And it was like, if I tried to buy the same place in L.A., it would have caught, you know,
yeah.
I'd be like everybody else in L.A. You know, it's like, I have a nice car, neat looking house, no furniture, and I, you know, you can, no basement, and it costs 10 times as much. So, I just look stupid. I'm not that stupid. So there's part of the reason.
Yeah.
And now coming up, there's going to be the Hard Rock Casino Rockford, which I'm the main guy behind it.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. Going to be.
Is that over where the clock tower was?
Yeah. The clock tower ain't there no more.
Right.
Yeah. We bought the place, bought that property, and we demolished the whole thing. And it took me about 12 years to get the okay, and we're still screwing around with the state of Illinois. But that's going to be here. It's going to bring... I don't need another job. It's going to be probably at least 1,000 jobs or so to here.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. And as I put it, it's kind of a trust or an estate for my family. So that's the Nielsen. That's where we got the idea for the band, the other band I play in, the Nielsen Trust.
Right.
Oh, I see.
Right. Very cool.
Yeah.
Did you ever consider living in Japan?
Yes, I did.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
You lived there?
No, I considered it.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to live there maybe 3 months a year. I wanted to live in London for 3 months a year.
Ah.
I wanted to live in Tokyo for 3 months a year, or somewhere in Japan. And because I knew that I could work people like me there, for one.
Yeah.
Unlike band at Lincoln Junior High School. They liked me there. And it's like, I'm sure I could get enough work doing producing stuff. I didn't want to do big productions and stuff like that, because I don't have enough patience to sit still for that long.
Mm-hmm.
But 3 months of the year, I mean, because I love the culture over there. Like I said, they treat me better than I deserve, just like I do.
What do you think, Rick, was the reason you guys caught on over there the way you did?
They liked our songs.
Mm-hmm.
They liked our songs. I mean, you know, we have kind of a, I don't know, if a cartoonish, or not a cartoonish look, but we're recognizable as individuals.
Yep.
Which, you know, like Queen were and Kiss were.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't just another band, the lead singer and then the other guys. You know,
yep.
So I think that was part of it. And they liked our songs. I mean, we had from our second album, we had a number one song, Clock Strikes 10, with number one in Japan. We, you know, never, we never.
That's amazing.
Number no thousand in U.S.
Yeah.
So, you know, they like this, and it's like a lot of the Japanese people, they learn how to speak English by listening to rock records. And it's like, you know, so are they all singing all your songs? You go talk to them, it's like, they don't really know it, but they know it phonetically, which is good enough for me.
Yeah. Right, right. That's very interesting. Yeah, yeah. Well, I always tell my kids that almost everything I learned, like you, I don't think I learned very much in school, but I did learn a lot of stuff from records, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, sure.
All the songs about history and all these things came from albums, and that's the only knowledge I had.
You know, when I was in school, my dad was a pretty smart guy. He graduated college when he was either 16 or 17.
Wow.
And, but he liked his religion, you know, so that's what he did what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And, when I was in school, it's like if I liked the teacher and they were good teachers, I did real well.
Mm-hmm.
If I thought I was smarter than the teacher, and I knew I was, I had real trouble. You know, like I was head of the DE list. But otherwise, you know, like I knew what I was doing, but that's not what I wanted to do. You know,
right.
What am I going to do with the? You know, I can think of anything, but. What just wasn't my vocation to be.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Well, what I was going to say is that a line like, I want you to want me, sounds like something you might learn in, you know, a language class or something like that, right? You know, it has a certain cadence to it and a certain...
Yeah, well, I always liked rhymes and stuff like that. So it was like, you know, I wish I could be that stupid more often, you know, like, that put my kids through school. You know?
Yeah.
That's one of those choruses, though, that I have to think that when you wrote that, when you came up with that, you must have thought I really got something here, because it's that example of something that's like simple work and it works really well, and yet nobody before you had put that together, right?
Yeah, it was kind of funny because it's like, you know, my favorite like Jeff Beck, I mean, he's like uncharted territory, and I like stuff like the Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. It was like, I was always trying to play above my pay grade or my talent. But I like that stuff. And so doing that Want You, Don't Want Me is, oh, this is so dumb. We did it kind of almost as a joke. Not really as a joke, but it was so simple.
Yeah.
That, you know. I've got about 50 different individuals and bands and whatever, you know, it's been on American Idol, it's been on this and that, it's been, you know, a ton of people have played them. Like heavy metal bands will do some of our songs. It's like, and they, just all this stuff is pretty funny.
All right, how great is that? Rick Nielsen, everyone.
Unbelievable, Jim. The charisma of Robin Zander, the genius of Rick Nielsen.
That's right. I mean, legendary,
says everything,
right?
About our listeners. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yep.
And what a sharp guy that he is, man. So sharp. You really got to stay on your toes, you know, because he's constantly, you know, I thought at first, like, oh, this will be cool. Like, we'll ask him a couple questions and he'll tell us some long stories and we can just sit back and listen. But no way, man. He was like firing the one-liners
totally.
The whole time.
Although he did have some good stories, too. I mean,
he did. Yeah.
So anyway, that's just part one of the interview. We're going to.
I know. It gets better.
We're going to stop it there. We're going to pause it there, and we're going to press play again tomorrow, and you're going to hear the second half of the interview. So the celebration that is episode 1000 kind of seeps over into 1001, all right?
That's right. We're not going to do it small, folks.
That's right. So you're going to hear more from Rick tomorrow, and we were so thrilled to have him on the show. So there
absolutely.
You go. One last thing I want to say before we go into tomorrow's episode, that you can also now, as of today, listen to the Suburbs Pod 1000, which is a special playlist that we put together on Spotify. We each contributed half the songs, and they're just songs that we really like, right?
Right.
1,000 songs, right?
And that's the criteria, Jim. We just like these songs.
Yep.
And we hope you like them, too. And maybe you'll find one you never heard before or, you know, find an old favorite. So
go on our social media, Facebook or Twitter or Instagram at Suburbs Pod, and we'll have the link to the playlist there. Or we should have an article on our website, suburbspod.com, that has the playlist embedded there as well. So
totally. And, you know, if you get locked up for 48 hours and they let you have your phone and headphones, this would be perfect, you know, or anything. If you have a very long drive or...
That's right.
You have to quarantine, for example. All these uses would be good.
Yep. All right. Check that out. And now, as we embark on our second 1,000 episodes, tune in tomorrow for the thrilling conclusion of the interview with Rick Nielsen. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
Okay, that's it? Okay, bye, guys.
Well.